This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And we'll begin with the latest piece of news on colorectal cancer. We've been covering the alarming increase in younger people over the last few years. It has spiked. Now, the Canadian Cancer Society is calling on governments to lower the age of screening to 45 from 50. And there's also another story that is sort of related because it is about obesity, and that can be a cause of colon cancer. According to the Canadian Institute for Health Information, taxpayer-funded drug plans shelled out over $20 billion on prescription drugs, which is an increase of more than 9%, nearly 10% in 1 year, and the highest annual growth rate in 20 years. And the cause of most of this was Ozempic. So it is just another piece of the puzzle in our ongoing discussion about how to sustain the increasing cost of prescription drugs, especially the newer ones. So if you have a question or a comment on this, the text line is 866-740-4740. That's also the long distance phone line. And the local phone line, 416-360-0740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'm joined by Dr. Malcolm Moore, who's a medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, former head of BC Cancer, Dr. Fahad Razak, general internist at St. Michael's Hospital, and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the U of T, and Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. So let's start with this recommendation to lower the screening age. This is screening, population screening for people who are at average risk. So, Malcolm, is that a good idea? Do you think that will be useful?
Okay, I can't just give you a yes or no on this one. So first of all, screening for colorectal cancer is beneficial. And in Ontario, it's 50 to 70, 70 plus. And the way it's done is something called a FIT test, which is testing stool to see if there's blood from possibly from a bleeding tumor. And then if that is positive, then you have a colonoscopy. So the check, and we've also heard separately that the number of the rate of rise of colon cancer in people under 50 is higher than average. But just a bit of a reality check here, because I think it's fair for the Cancer Society to advocate for prolonged screening, but we have to look critically at the cost effectiveness of this, because there's lots of other things like funding more emergency rooms that we can spend healthcare dollars on. So just a few facts. Around 7 or 8% of colon cancer occurs in patients under 50. So most patients are over 50. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in that population, the incidence of any person in that age group getting colon cancer in a year is about 0.03%. So it's in an individual person, it's quite rare. So in Ontario, we have about a million people between 45 and 50. So if we screened all of those people, annual cost would be around $250 to $300 million. And that would probably pick up maybe 200 colon cancers. And some of those people may be saved because of that. So it's really a question of cost effectiveness. Would spending $300 million to screen that age group to detect around 200 cancers, how does that stack up against all of the other things that we would like to spend healthcare dollars on? And that's where smart people like Fahad and groups sit down and look at this critically and say, where does this fit on the screening spectrum? I would say, honestly, I'm a colon cancer doctor, so I want people to be screened. I think the cost effectiveness of screening people younger than 50 is going to be quite high.
I'm looking at the study that the CCS used for this, and the author is a guy named Darren Brenner, who is out of Calgary. And according to his research, and I'm assuming that's at the national level, that this screening would actually save $233 million in the cost of treatment. Does that change the equation for you, Malcolm?
Well, again, you know, cost effectiveness analyses are complicated. And that's why in Ontario, when we approve things, we have kind of an independent cost effectiveness review of looking at what are the costs of doing this, what are the savings. And so I think we have to look at this very, all I'm saying is we have to look at this very carefully before we change the recommendations. And I think that's where we're at the present time.
Okay. Alisa, as a family doctor, do patients embrace this? Because I remember when these home tests kind of first came out, it was a long time ago. But I think there's, frankly, a bit of an ick factor. And I'm not sure that everybody who should be doing it actually does it.
So the good thing about colon cancer screening is that once you turn age 50 and you're part of the screening a cohort, which goes from 50 to 74, you receive notification from the government on a two-year basis in terms of to do a FIT test, which is a stool test that you do at home. And that's the recommendation. And then as part of the colon cancer screening strategy, we usually try to have people do a colonoscopy. So there is definitely an ick factor related to the colonoscopy. Usually that's a harder sell if somebody is maybe on the fence and doesn't want to get it done. But generally, then you're able to have them complete at least the stool test that they do at home. So there's generally high uptake amongst in that test category. And the government does do a good job. People will get a screening letter in the mail and then they do contact me and then we send it into the lab and it gets sent to their home. They complete the test at home and they can either drop it off at a lab or they can mail it back. So usually people will agree to do something. It's very rare for somebody not to agree to do anything when you discuss the importance of colon cancer screening.
Okay, well, that's good news. Fahad, what's your take on the cost-benefit analysis? Is this something you think Ontario should take up, lowering the screening age?
Yeah, I would really align with the way Malcolm described it. You try as a physician and someone who looks at the data to distinguish the individual tragic cases. And I think I've mentioned on a prior show, we had a very close friend of ours who died in her 40s, early 40s from colon cancer. So this is very close to our heart, close to my heart. And I see cases like this in the hospital. But Malcolm's point is right in that we have to talk about system costs. And so I would love, should Ontario do it? I would love the Ontario body, we have a body that looks specifically at these questions, to do just a very hard-nosed assessment to talk about the benefit per case detected. If that comes out to be within the range of what we can fund, absolutely. But until I see that, I don't think I would endorse doing this because it's a constrained system. If we pull money to do this, it means we don't pay for something else. And so it's these trade-offs. So I just want to see that it's clearly cost effective in a province like Ontario. If it is, absolutely. I mean, and again, I don't want to take away from the individual tragedy of the cases that occur. We have to think about 16 million people and how to provide the best holistic care for them.
And the numbers cited in that CCS study, savings of $233 million, I'm assuming that's national. that doesn't sway you?
It sways me in the sense of it's a very, you know, if that is the case, if the numbers bear out in our analysis, that the reason we have these bodies is because advocacy agencies, again, the Canadian Cancer Society, incredibly important organization, but it is an advocacy organization and it advocates for cancer, which is fantastic, but it doesn't advocate for autism or rheumatologic disease or heart disease. So I want to see an objective body that has to make assessments for the whole system, tell us that this is cost beneficial in Ontario. And then again, absolutely, at a clinical individual patient level, my heart goes to these patients. But I think we have to think about this differently when we're talking about the system. So that's why we have these neutral bodies that don't have conflicts of interest, that aren't paid by any organization. They make the calls on balls and stripes.
Okay, well, another issue.
Point to make.
Go ahead.
The other point I just want to make about fit tests is that about 10% of fit tests are positive, and over 95% of those are what we call false positives, which means they're not caused by cancer. So you might say, well, a fit test is pretty cheap. I think it's about $75. But, you know, if 10% of the people who have fit tests then have to have a colonoscopy, that's what Fahad means by looking at the total system costs of implementing what seems like a very simple test.
How much does a colonoscopy cost?
I think it's about $1,000 all in.
Fahad is nodding, so I guess that's what it is.
Yeah, and Libby, the way to think about it is, you know, there is... So again, I think the simple message is, oh, it's just a test, but there's the person taking a day off of work, they're coming in, there's the investigator's time, who's doing the procedure, the nursing staff and the anesthesiologist who's needed in the room booking costs. Some small percentage have a complication and then have to come back into hospital because of it. So this is where you want to get that full picture. You know, there's a really good parallel to what we're talking about today to those Alzheimer's drugs that we talked about in the last couple of weeks, right? Because if you just say, oh, it's just this amount of money for the drug, well, but that's not the total cost. That's not how you think about this, because there's the whole ecosystem of stuff that has to happen around it once you make the call to fund something.
Okay, well, another aspect of this conversation about what do we fund and what do we not fund. So Kai Hai, Canadian Institute of Health Information, just released the numbers on publicly paid prescription drugs. And we saw the biggest increase, the biggest yearly increase in 20 years. It was like 9.3% increase in just 1 year. And Ozempic seemed to be at the heart of most of it. Malcolm.
Okay, so drugs have traditionally over the last decade been going, the amount we spend on drugs as a percentage has gone up at a greater rate than all other aspects of healthcare. But still, like in Ontario now, we spend $90 billion on healthcare. We spend about $7 billion, $6 or $7 billion on drugs. It's about 7% of the budget. So it's not as big. The big thing in Ontario are hospitals and doctors, and then drugs is third. So it's always been going up higher than the kind of rate of inflation or the rate of increments of healthcare. And to be honest, and this is a good thing because there's been lots of advances in cancer, the biggest culprit driving the drug costs in the last few years has been cancer drugs, which are really expensive. So, but cancer, you know, you don't have a lot of patients with these different advanced cancers. When you start talking about drugs like Ozempic, which a larger proportion of the population can get, even though the costs may be less than, let's say, a cancer drug, because so many patients are taking them, it can have kind of a disproportionate impact. And I think it does get into this conversation about the fact that we now have generic Ozempic drugs. They're still under the review process. And once they are approved, that should give a substantial saving to the public drug plans.
Yeah, we're expecting that. None of them, I think there's six, and none of them have been approved by Health Canada yet. But isn't it the case, okay, Ozempic is the latest blockbuster drug, but there will be others, even if they won't necessarily affect quite as many people as Ozempic, Fahad?
Ozempic and the class that it represents, I think Libby is a pretty special case because 70% of Canadians are now overweight or obese. One in three Canadians is now obese. We don't have a condition that is that prevalent, which has so many downstream consequences. Remember, this is an underlying risk factor for arthritis, many kinds of cancer, heart disease, liver disease, kidney disease. It is remarkable how many things obesity is implicated in. So you have a condition where one in three Canadians is obese. Then you have the development of essentially a revolutionary treatment. And again, I don't want to understate how revolutionary these class of drugs are in terms of the effect on obesity. So those two things coming together is truly a pretty remarkable occurrence in terms of how we think about drugs, costs, and the way that you could change the trajectory of this thing, obesity, which affects people across the board and affects diseases across the board. This is a case where the economic analysis is starting to come out now to suggest maybe you do actually cover this from the public purse because the downstream effects on so many different diseases is going to be consequential. I don't think the evidence is there yet. My guess is that we're going to get to a place where this drug is covered. And are the incremental new ones more effective than Ozempic? Yeah, they are. But then the benefit is marginal. So the difference between Ozempic versus nothing is remarkable. Like I said, cannot overstate how remarkable it is. Then Ozempic versus Mounjaro or whatever, we're talking about little marginal effects beyond that. And that's where I think you anchor in on the generic one. So look, I think we're in for some really interesting times now about what's going to happen here. And my guess is we're going to get to a place where one of these drugs in generic form is going to be widely covered.
Elisa? Elisa?
Libby, it's the only drug that people come in and ask for by name. I've said many times I have trouble getting people to take a blood pressure medication. A statin is a very hard sell, but people will come in and know Ozempic by name, and everybody wants it. So I can see that it will continue to expand, and for a lot of people, the limiting factor in being able to take the drug is that they can't afford it. So they could have private insurance and they don't qualify, or it's not covered by their plan, or they're a cash pay and they just don't have the money for an ongoing cost monthly. So this is something that as the price comes down, more and more people will go on the drug, and people are just, every time people come and see me, they're like, "Did it get approved yet? Is the generic available?" And I'm like, "No, we're still waiting, but hopefully it will be soon." It's interesting that the companies are starting to drop the price of their drugs. And there is better patient assistance programs. So the price has come down by often $100 per pen. So we're moving in the right direction. But once it becomes even cheaper, you'll see more and more people who will be taking this drug.
We've also talked to Lisa about side effects and people going off the drug because it has side effects. Have you seen a lot of patients who are affected like that?
So the literature quotes, or maybe not the literature, but from experience and from what is generally quoted, it's about 50% of people aren't able to stay on Ozempic. Now, there is better coverage for Ozempic or for Wegovy, which is the same drug but used as a weight loss drug at higher levels. So people who can't tolerate it for many reasons, some people actually don't lose weight. So people should be aware that not everybody has such a large drastic response that you see commonly in social media, but that there's a lot of GI side effects. So constipation can be quite bothersome. People will get abdominal pain and people will come off of the drug. Mounjaro or Zepbound, which is the equivalent for weight loss, is generally better tolerated than Wegovy and will have a better weight loss profile. It's a stronger drug. It covers two gut hormones instead of one. So there's appears to be better tolerability for that drug, but there's very little third-party coverage for it exists. So a lot of people will have to go on Wegovy and either come off of it completely, or we try to get people drop down to a lower dose where we're able to maintain whatever weight loss they've had. But side effects is a big part of this drug.
Moving right along. So you were talking about common conditions here. So there was a study on the top five fastest growing common conditions. Kidney disease and failure is at the top of the list. That's often a side effect of diabetes. And I don't know if people are generally aware of that, Malcolm.
Well, I think this is an age thing to a large degree. Like, I think what this article said was that proportionately there's been a higher rate of rise of chronic kidney disease than some other diseases. When you look at the chronic diseases of elderly that are most common, dementia, cancer, heart disease, arthritis, kidneys not in the top five in terms of frequency, but the increase has been greater. But again, all of these things are a function of an aging population. You know, the average age is getting higher, more people are living longer, and our birth rate now has fallen below the sustainable population level, so that we kind of have fewer younger people in the population. So I think all of these things are what's stressing the healthcare system. And just point out that I'm in the cancer business, where we're trying to prepare for this onslaught of increased number of cases. But there's lots of other medical services, dementia, kidney disease, that need to prepare just the same.
And what kind of an increase are you trying to prepare for?
Well, in cancer, we have pretty good statistics. So I would say in cancer, the population, I think, is growing around 1 to 1.5% a year. The number of cancer cases in the last few years has been going up in the region of 4% a year, again, primarily because of the increasing aging of the population. Now, at some point, that'll level off, but that's what we're dealing with at the moment.
But generally speaking, survival rates, and it's hard to generalize, are going up, right?
Survival rates are definitely going up, and people are staying on treatment longer. That adds to the costs of care. Wow. But, you know, as I said, at the same time, we're dealing with this not only just more complicated care, but also increasing frequency of cancers because of the age of the population.
Okay. And Fahad, in your practice, have you seen more of the growing chronic conditions like kidney disease?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do general medical care, kind of critical care on the hospital ward. So we're about, depending on the hospital, about 40% of the entire hospital's volume of admissions come to these wards. And the defining factor pretty much is multiple chronic illnesses for the patients we're admitting. So the average patient has at least five chronic illnesses by the time they come to see us, kidney disease being one of the most common. And, you know, going back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, kidney disease is a really fascinating example, because historically in the United States, the only thing that was covered by the public health system before, you know, we've had these advances in insurance was kidney disease, because historically it used to be a very rare condition. But the vast majority of kidney disease today is not from some rare immune condition. It's from, as you said, diabetes and obesity related causes. So as those things have risen in society, kidney disease has become this kind of common chronic illness that we have to manage. For the vast majority of people, it needs medication, but increasingly a subset of those people will advance to dialysis, which then becomes hugely consequential. We're talking about sophisticated equipment, often days, daily management and therapy at home, or two or three times a week coming into hospital to get that managed. So it's a very consequential condition. And I'm not surprised that it's kind of bubbled up as a major driver in this analysis. And I should just mention also, this analysis was done by very close colleagues of ours at the University of Toronto. And what they're trying to do is give more of a predictive insight about what's coming. So we're not always in this kind of reactive way of saying, oh, well, there's this condition that's really common, we should manage it. No, they're trying to say, here's what's coming and here's how much it's going to increase by, plan now for its management.
Okay. Last word to you, Elisa. Have you seen hints of that increase in your practice?
Absolutely. As people age, their kidney function declines. So in general, there's a 1% drop in your kidney function per year. And when you layer on additional chronic medical conditions, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity. You find that it's not very uncommon now that people will have declining EGFRs or increasing creatinines as they age. The good news is that there's better medical management now than that there was, and there's new guidelines, Ontario guidelines for the management of kidney disease. But there will just continue to be, as our population ages, more and more medical problems and medical conditions, and the cost of care will just continue to increase. And I think we should all just take this as a warning of that there needs to be real improvement within the system to help to manage our aging population.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Dr. Elisa Naiman, Dr. Malcolm Moore, and Dr. Fahad Razak. And we will talk again soon. Bye-bye.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, it is the Premier's latest foray into waterfront development and into an area that many consider to be the purview of the City of Toronto. Doug Ford says the province will expropriate the city's portion of the land that Billy Bishop Airport sits on in order to facilitate an expansion of the airport, which includes bringing jets. Now, I think that the public is now on board with that plan, even though there is going to be significant opposition. Don't forget that former Toronto Mayor David Miller won an election on that issue, fighting an expansion of the downtown airport. So what do you think, people? Should we expand Billy Bishop Airport or should we not do it? The text line is 866-740-4740. You can also make a long-distance call on that line. Local phone line is 416-360-0740. And joining me now is Lisa Raitt, a former president and CEO of the Toronto Port Authority. Also a former transport minister, so somebody who knows a lot about this issue. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Libby. Great to be here. The night David Miller won on his whole, remember the broom?
The broom, him holding the broom, yes.
Yeah, holding the broom up. I watched the results roll in, and at that point I said, well, that's it for the airport. We had deals already with Porter. We had deals with construction. And I knew that the next 2 years of my life was going to be a lot of lawsuits and settlements. And indeed it was. And here we are almost 25 years later.
And is it the right time? I mean, Doug Ford says that they've been doing polling. 70% of people are in favor. Do you agree with that? Or is it going to be a tough slog?
I think that the airport has proven itself to be a good neighbor, and I think more people have moved into the neighborhood and actually enjoy having the airport there for its own convenience. There's always going to be opposition. It's going to be really vocal, and they should be. I mean, this is what they're supposed to be doing, have their vocal opposition. Do I think that Doug Ford is going to experience a backlash at the polls because he's going to upload the property of the City of Toronto? I don't think so. I think he's done the calculus. And the other thing, too, is I guess we have to get a sense as to what expansion really means. They're not going to land 747s there. You can't expand the runway enough to get it. But what you can get in there are private jets. And I'd be interested to see what kind of airport the island airport becomes.
That's interesting. We were thinking that the main source of opposition would be the very well-organized residents of Toronto Islands. And I don't know if it helped or hurt that Doug Ford called them squatters. I call them mooches. That gets a lot of people's backup. I mean, they have very special deals that the rest of us who want to own a home in anywhere in this area don't have. Is that where you see the main opposition, or is it all the people who are in, you know, market condos along the waterfront?
It's real. I can contrast it with the opposition that we had 20 years ago to the bringing in a fixed link to the Island Airport, which would increase the traffic, and it did. The opposition then kind of fell in two places. Definitely the Toronto Islands. For sure, they wanted to maintain their quality of life, and they felt that the air traffic would take away from that. But as well, at the time, those condos along the water were actually full of people who had retired. They weren't starter homes by any means. They were more on the luxury side, more people who had retired so they could look at the water every day. They were very vocally opposed as well. Now that mix is very different down on the waterfront. You're more as apt to have a young up-and-comer who wants to jump on a flight to New York City for the weekend or to let's say Halifax, Nova Scotia, for example, for the weekend, not using the American reference, as you are to have somebody who gets annoyed when they see a plane outside their window. I think that the time is right. And I also think what the premier recognized is the city would never be able to get the support to make the changes to the airport that is being sought. I think that the politics around it is such that the small council and the mayor would never be able to do it. So the only way to get it done is for the province to take it over.
Well, I don't think the small council and the mayor have an inclination to do it.
Correct.
To do it. Yeah. What about the argument that there is already so much congestion down there? That, you know, where that is just going to make things a lot worse. And even now, I mean, just because it's close to where you might be doesn't mean that it's going to be any quicker getting there.
True. It's definitely not a place where you're driving your car and you're parking and you're flying off. It has to be a place where you're going to get an Uber, a taxi, or you're going to end up trying to find public transit that gets you there, or the buses that are provided, the shuttles. And that should be the way. You know, there's a couple of pinch points on that airport in terms of what will actually take it from being a positive experience to a negative experience. One was always getting across the channel. They sorted that out with the tunnel. Another is how what size airplane you can have and how far the distance they can go. That's what they're trying to do with the jets. The third one, though, is what you point out, which is the choke of the traffic around the ground side, as we call it, not the air side, the ground side. And that can put people off. If you can't, like Montreal Airport, you can't get into Montreal Airport because the traffic is so bad, people don't want to take it anymore. So that is going to be the part that the Port Authority and the province of Ontario are going to have to figure out as well. So there's lots of ways the city can continue to stymie the efforts of the airport, not to give them any ideas.
And I'm going to take a call from Ron in Guelph. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Libby. It's been a long time since I've actually been on the radio. So anyway, so here's my take on this thing. I can remember when the election was taking place with David Miller. It wasn't that group, large group of people. There's a few people that lived in those apartments down there that made the most noise. And my take has always been the same thing that people argue about when they move to a new subdivision close to Pearson. Well, you knew the airport was there when you moved there. So the airport has been there for a long time. The other issue is about the noise. Well, I was at the air show on Labor Day with my son probably at least 10 years ago, when out of the nowhere, there was a Bombardier. This was a jet, a smaller jet. It went across, and the commentator even said, did anybody hear that plane? It was a jet that could have been landing at Billy Bishop Airport. You couldn't hear that plane.
Okay, well, they say that the jets aren't what they used to be. So, Lisa, before I let you go, we have a few more weeks, I guess, to vote for the names of the electric ferries.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's
okay, so I'll give you the finalist names.
Okay, great.
Okay, Harbor Swan, Island Willow, Lady of the Kays, the Harbor Passage, Toronto Islander, Water Strider, Discovery 6. Oh my God, it's going on forever. Island Chickadee and Cloudbreaker.
No, go with the swan.
Go with
Swan's
the swan.
Swan's royalty. I like it. Yeah, swan's royalty. I like it.
Okay. Swans are actually pretty nasty creatures, but
that's true. They'll attack.
I'm sure that we will have a chance to talk to you again about this. Just final thing in terms of the city, are they going to, I'm thinking this is just a great opportunity for Olivia Chow to shrug her shoulders and say, I couldn't do anything.
Yeah, I think that is exactly what would be attractive to her. And it takes it out from being a municipal election issue. But listen, the sleeper on this is what happens on the federal side, because the federal government is involved in this as well. And even though the province may take over the city's portion, you still got to get the feds to agree to lengthening the runways and allowing for jets. That could be a place where the opposition will turn to next.
And you think that's you think they won't be on side?
I've never had a good experience with the Liberal government in sticking by what they wanted to do on the Island Airport. I've been burned way too many times with the Liberals on the Island Airport, saying quietly that they love it, and then at the last minute cratering and giving the municipality or the residents what they want, a la David Miller and Paul Martin, which ended up me becoming a cabinet minister eventually. So I kind of thank them for that moment, but not really.
Okay. As I said, a controversial issue from 20 years ago. Yeah. Back with us, Lisa Wright. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Libby. Pleasure talking to you. Bye.
Okay. Well, now we are going to hear the other side and what they might think they're going to do about it. We have Norm DePasquale, who is the chair of No Jets, TO. Hello, Norm. There you are. Hello, Norm.
And there I am. Hello.
Here you are. Hello. So as we've been talking about with Lisa Wright, former head of the Port Authority, yesterday, Doug Ford said, you know, he was sitting around the kitchen with Olivia Chow and told her, OK, I'm expropriating your part of Billy Bishop Airport and I'll pay you for it. But we're going to expand the airport.
Yeah, and I'm extremely disappointed that Premier Ford is taking, you know, this decision away from Torontonians, effectively shutting us out of the airport debate by simply trying to steal the airport away from Torontonians. Torontonians deserve to have a say on the future of our waterfront, and they deserve to have a say in this airport debate. So we put out a press release condemning that and fighting for Torontonians to have a say.
Okay. The province clearly has the jurisdiction. They can do it if they want. I mean, the cities altogether are a creature of the province. So when you say stealing it, I'm not sure how accurate that is.
Yeah. So the city and the federal government and Transport Canada just signed a new tripartite agreement about the around the island airport. And there are questions about whether the province can rip up this signed contract with federal entities and simply become the city in that contract. And I think that might be interesting to test in the court of law. And there was a great article in Spacing magazine that said the same thing today.
Okay, so what does that agreement say in terms of?
Yeah, so it's called the Tripartite Agreement, and it's an agreement between the city, the federal government, and Transport Canada on airport operation. And it sets rules like, you know, no jets are permitted at the island airport. There can be a number of movements. You know, and details about, you know, not being able to expand the airport's you know, sort of size without, you know, a further agreement by all parties. So, you know, the first one was from 2033, but they recently reopened it and signed the agreement to 2045. So we're talking about a pretty ironclad agreement between the city and federal parties. And I'm just not sure that Ontario can simply insert themselves in that and if that's legal.
Well, we just heard from Lisa Wright. She expects, I think, a hard time from the federal government on this. So maybe you have some allies there. But, you know, it's unlikely that the very left wing leaning city council will be in favor of this. So what are you going to do to fight it?
Yeah, and you know, to speak to City Council for a minute, we fought this battle in 2014 and we won, but City Council voted for like sort of a phased approach to, you know, potential airport expansion, where, you know, the airport had to satisfy certain requirements to keep moving through the phases. So the city didn't outright say no, but they said, you know, we have to take this slow, get all of the facts on the table, which I think is really important. But, you know, you're totally right with respect to the federal government. We are going to be reaching out to MPPs. We have a petition now that goes to your MP, MPP, councillor, etc. We have to apply pressure and make sure that the federal government, you know, stands up for Toronto's vision for a revitalized waterfront, which they invested in.
Okay, I'm going to read a couple of texts before we wrap up on this. So an unknown texter writes, the Toronto Island Airport is vital to the economic viability of the City of Toronto. It would reduce somewhat the congestion at Toronto International Airport and the traffic between that location and the Toronto downtown area. So that, from an unknown texter, adds up to they are in favor of expanding it. And, we got more info on the short list of the names for the new electric ferries. Do you have a thought on that, Norm, as we wrap you up?
I'm so excited about the electric ferries. That's the kind of thing we need on our revitalized waterfront. We don't need to reindustrialize our waterfront for jets. We've invested billions. Let's respect that investment, which is
no, but
a great return.
What should the name be?
Let's see. How about Ferry McFerry Face?
Okay, Ferry McFerry Face. I don't even see that on the quite long short list, but Norm DePasquale, thanks so much for being with us.
Have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, we are taking another break. And when you're traveling, do you give thought on the advantages of traveling with a Canadian passport? We will talk about that when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, I always feel grateful to be traveling with a Canadian passport, and it's a feeling that I've had since I started traveling as a very young woman. And back then, there was a lot of anti-American sentiment, even in Western Europe. Probably it's resurgent. So, now there is a ranking to prove that I had good reason to feel that way, and it is an annual international ranking of the mobility of passports, and Canada has retained its spot in the top 10. We come in at number 7, and it's the Henley ranking of mobility. And what it means is that we can visit 182 countries without a visa, which is very convenient. But what does not mean, what recent events has shown, is that we will not necessarily have an easy time getting out of places if we get stuck because of war, because of hurricanes and other natural events, or because of a pandemic. So what is your thought on this, on holding Canadian passport that continues to be at number 7? And also, what are your thoughts of the last week when a lot of people were stuck because of the war in the Middle East, and basically the Canadian government said, don't call us, we can't help you. So the text line, 866-740-4740. That's also the long-distance phone line. And the local phone line, 416-360-0740. And now let's go to Martin Firestone, president of Travel Secure, Inc., and Devin Perry, a travel advisor and owner of Devin Perry Travel. So, Devin, do people appreciate having the Canadian passport?
Well, I think most people certainly do. I actually had to go get a new passport last week, and I had the same sentiment as you. When I went in there and that thing was handed to me, like, it's a pretty great feeling to get to have. So yes, I think there's a lot of ease for us that comes with having that passport for sure. And I think that as of late, that sort of, you know, proudness around it, also when you're traveling to places like Europe, is sort of like resurged to your point, similar to what it was, you know, 20 years ago.
Marty, what's your take on that? And also, we've often talked about what it actually would take for people to get reimbursed when they get stuck for whatever reason, even if they have insurance. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, lots of things going on. I think one other comment I would make, and Devin maybe can confirm, there still is some new requirements between the ETA for England and I believe the ETIS for the Schengen countries, over 30 countries. So you know, you might want to address that. Ultimately, you have to get that kind of requirement done in addition to your passport. As far as traveling and trip cancellation interruption, never has become a bigger product from my insurance lineup now. You just have to buy it when you have non-refundable dollars that you're putting out with all that's going on in the world right now.
Yeah, when you, the other things you mentioned, those are some new fees that travelers are going to have to pay. So it's not so much that we're going to be necessarily screened from a security perspective, but we're going to have to put down some more money to visit certain places. Right, Marty?
That and facial recognition or fingerprinting, like they want to know who they're being very, you know, stringent. They want to know who's coming into their country. But once you get it for that one ETIS, then it's good for 30 countries. And for England, it's the ETA. So, yeah, that's what it's all about. Just knowing when you're in and when you're leaving. That's the key.
Okay. Devin, can you give us a little bit of detail? Who has to get those now and what's involved?
Yeah, currently right now, it's specific to the UK. So it's similar to Caribbean countries have had this for a long time, places like Jamaica, places like the Dominican Republic. And what it is it's an entrance visa for a short period of time for short-term travelers. So it's very simple. There is links online. Sherpa is a great place to go and get any requirements needed when you're traveling. You can simply enter your, you know, passport, origin, destination, and where you're going. And it'll actually tell you exactly what you need and where to find that link. So the UK right now is one of the regions that now has introduced a short-term visa. There is a small fee that goes along with it. And again, I handle many visas, so I'm not quite sure exactly of the cost. I think it's less than $30 and it's good for 5 years. So once you've done it, you're actually able to go back within the next 5 years and not have to do it again. It's a very simple process where they just want some dates and information on when you're traveling, and then that's issued almost immediately. There has been talks about the rest of the EU needing a similar document. It has been postponed over the past 2 years at least 5 times. They're talking about it being ready, I think, in the fall is the latest, but as of now, I don't think there's any sense getting ahead of it until it's been introduced and it's actually in market. We're sort of in a we'll believe it when we see it situation because it has been moved so many times.
Okay. I mean, Marty, I mean, I remember filling those out. We've been to the Dominican Republic a couple of times, and then you have to hand the customs agent $20 US in cash. And I've always wondered about that. Oh, gee, I'm sure none of that money goes astray.
It's a cash grab, no doubt about it.
We have this, which is probably more inspired by getting more money, I would think, and also getting a handle on who is traveling. So does that, in your opinion, Marty, erode the value of our passport?
None at all. The Schengen countries, and again, I'm not sure when that's going into place, that is more for security. That's more for the country to know. We know who's coming in. We know how long they're staying. That was the key. Like, people got through, and then you ended up not leaving again. This is now a way to track that kind of thing. So I think that's all more about security at the end of the day. But our passport, who's kidding, 182 countries, up one from last year, we should be proud, and we should be happy to have a Canadian passport.
Okay, well, what about the other side of it? And that is, if you get stuck, well, we saw what happened where people getting stuck, I mean, there really was no help to be had, certainly in the initial days from the Canadian government. And a lot of Canadians watched their counterparts from other countries, you know, able to get out, Devin.
Yeah, I'm not sure on why the government took that stance. There were ways to get out, but it was a lot more complicated than simply getting on a, you know, Canadian sent airline and coming back to Canada. There were opportunities to sort of take flights into other areas in Europe and come back. Airlines were reimbursing, so there was, you know, potential to be compensated for your original flight, or if you had insurance, and then also book from another destination. But yeah, there was a complete halt of flights and still is. And as of now, most of sort of the sort of communication in place is wait until those flights are resumed.
Okay, I'm going to take a quick call from Camille in Scarborough. Hi, Camille.
Hi there. Now, I think a lot of people use the Canadian passport as a safe haven passport. So I was shocked to find out it was 10,000 Canadians in the Middle East, trying, or get, wherever the danger is, trying to get out and back into Canada. So I, first of all, don't feel, I mean, I think they have to pay for their own airfare. But
I think they do. The government changed that. Yeah. And this time, I am totally on side about that when there are people I would consider Canadians of convenience who live somewhere else trying to get out. Mm-hmm. But I think part of the issue was that Dubai is a huge hub. And there were all kinds of people traveling through to Dubai, you know, going to India or something, mm-hmm. who were actually stuck, who were not. I mean, I would totally agree. I certainly don't want to pay for people who live somewhere else with mm-hmm. a passport of convenience. But I think the government, I'm quite sure the government addressed that after we paid $92 million in 2006.
Right, right. But I also think that the they had to get to a safe spot. Like, I don't think it was that easy to get the planes or whatever, or, you know, everybody's trying to get out. So if the government was trying to get people onto commercial flights, there was people from other countries trying to get on those commercial flights too. So I kind of think it wasn't as easy as just, oh, let's just send some planes into Iran and we'll get them out. It wasn't like that. They had to get to a safe country first, and then they could go in, you know. And then there had to be room on the commercial flight. So I think it was more complicated than
maybe. Oh, it definitely was complicated. Camille, I've got to wrap you up. We are over time. Thanks for your call. Thank you also to Devin Perry and Marty Firestone. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Libby.
Okay. That's all the time we have for Fight Back for today. I will be back here tomorrow, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.